Okay, so we are in Exodus. Today we're going to set a record for most number of chapters covered or skipped. Probably skipped would be a better term to use. Last week, and for several weeks, we've had this outline up on the board, which is what God is doing when he announces who he is for his people, to bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will take you for my people. And then each of these has a few points underneath it, like in green here, I will be your God. You will know that I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. We'll talk a little bit about that today. And then I will bring you to the land that I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And last week we saw that basically this is everybody's story. And we can use an outline like this as we strive to make God known in Sioux Falls and in other places, because it really is. It's my story. It's your story. It's everyone's story, because that's who God is. That's what he does. So last week we looked at what was called the Book of the Covenant, which began in Exodus, towards the end of Exodus chapter 20. And finished at the end of chapter 23. But the big point that is being made here is God creates this book of the covenant with his people is indicated at the beginning and at the end. It's how the book of the covenant opens, and it's how the book of the covenant closes. It opens with this: thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen that I have spoken to you from heaven. You shall not make other gods beside me. Gods of silver, gods of gold, you shall not make for yourself. And then it closes with this at the end of chapter, toward the end of chapter 23. You shall make no covenant with them or their gods. That's when God brings them into the new land. They shall not live in your land, because they will make you sin against me, and if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. So the big thing here in the covenant that God stresses over and over again throughout the terms of this covenant he's making with his people is no other gods. You can't have any other gods. We also saw last week that right before this ending, where it says, you shall make no covenant with them or with their gods, he says this: behold, I am going to send an angel before you, the people of Israel. This is Exodus 23, verses 20 and 21. Behold, I am going to send an angel before you to guard you along the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Be on your guard before him and obey his voice. Do not be rebellious toward him, for he will not pardon your transgression. Transgression is a kind of sin that is deliberately made, and it's a rebellious type act. Made the point last week that I think this is referring to something very specific. And since it's in this book of the covenant, I think it's referring to this: you shall make no other gods besides me. You shall not make covenants with other gods. You won't do that. Because this angel who I'm sending before you will not forgive, will not pardon your transgression. That rebellious act will not pardon, since my name is in him. So notice what it says about this messenger. God is saying his name, his reputation, his power, his essence, who he is in this angel that he is sending before them. So, at the end of this, terms of the covenant that we talked about last week, there's a ceremony, and it's common for there to be covenant ceremonies in along with the new covenant in the Old Testament, both between people and between God and people. Back in Genesis chapter 17, there's an example where God makes a covenant with Abraham. There's a ceremony when Laban and Jacob make Is that Isaac? Anyway, when the covenant is between Laban and, is it Isaac or Jacob, somebody? There's a covenant ceremony, a meal, yes, thank you. And so that's what we have in Exodus 24. So it begins like this, and I'll summarize a few points, and then we'll hit on some of the other ones. First of all, Moses is called to take Aaron and two of his sons, who are priests, and 70 of the elders of Israel. It doesn't say the 70 elders of Israel. It's 70 of the elders. So there are more elders than this. This is a representative of the people of Israel, and they're supposed to go up to on the mountain, on Mount Sinai, and worship God from a distance. And so what Moses does is he repeats to the people all the words of this book of the covenant that we talked about last time. And they say that everything that Yahweh has said, we're going to do. We're going to do all of these things from chapters 20 through 23. We're going to follow all of those rules. We agree that this is a covenant with God. He sets the terms. We're agreeing to them. This is a new covenant. This is what is talked about in point two up here. I will take you for my people. I will be your God. You will know that I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And so there's a ceremony that goes along with this. They make sacrifices, peace offerings to God. There's the blood that is splattered on the people and on the altar. It's common to have in ancient covenant ceremonies to have blood involved, and no different here. And then the people again repeat at the end of verse 7 of chapter 24, all that Yahweh has spoken, everything that He has told us, we will be obedient. We're going to do these things that are in the book of the covenant. Okay? So Moses then does take these, Aaron and Avihu and Nadav and 70 of the elders, and they go up on the mountain. So let's pick this up in verse 9 of chapter 24. Then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadav, and Avihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel. Okay, I'm going to pause there just for a second and think about that, right? So we can think about that. Now, what do we know? What is unusual here? They saw the God of Israel, right? What do we know about that? What do we think about? What do you think about when you from other parts of Scripture when you hear that? They will all die, right? And they will all die because they saw the God of Israel, right? So what? Something very unusual here happens though. Again in verse 10, and they saw the God of Israel. And they tell us all about what He looks like, right? And under His feet, there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire as clear as the sky itself. They don't mention really what He looks like, except that in some form that they're talking about here, it's appropriate to say that there's something under His feet. Yet, He did not stretch out His hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel, So they know that. Moses knows that when people look on the God of Israel, they're supposed to die. But for some reason, he does not do that. As part of this covenant meal, covenant ceremony that God is bringing to the people and the people are agreeing to. As part of this, this is something different from most things, most situations, any other situation that has ever happened. Okay? So this is a unique thing. They see the God of Israel, and yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel. So he doesn't kill them. We might think, well, what they didn't really see this. This is a vision. I don't think we can hide from the plain speech here that they went up, they saw the God of Israel, and yet he did not stretch out his hand against them. And then it repeats with a little bit different word, which could mean like gazed upon, and they saw God. So the people actually see God as part of this covenant, where covenant ceremony, where he is making them his people. Again, it's different from anything else ever. And they ate and drank, which it's common to have a meal at the end of a covenant ceremony. So that's what they did. Anybody want to talk about those things? Any of those things?
What's the original word that's used for God?
Pardon?
The original word that's used for God.
The word we used for God of Israel is Elohe Yisrael. So Elohim, with the idea that it's of Israel. So it's shortened a little bit. And in verse 11, it would also be Elohim.
Yeah.
There's no indication in the Old Testament that it would refer to Christ or to the second person of the Trinity. So, it's the general term. Elohim is the general term for God. Unlike Yahweh, which is the term, which is the name of God, the name of the high God. Yep. Now Yahweh said to Moses, verse 12, come up to me on the mountain and remain there, and I will give you the stone tablets with the law and the commandment which I have written for their instruction. So Moses and Joshua go up farther onto the mountain, and they tell the elders to just stay there. And remember that Moses has a special place. And the people of Israel, these people representative of Israel, have asked Moses, don't ever let God speak to us again. We're afraid of that. So Moses is the representative of those people as they go, as God speaks. And then in verse 15, a few important verses here as we go forward. Then Moses went up to the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain, and the glory of Yahweh rested on Mount Sinai. So important to note that this term glory of Yahweh. So the glory of the Lord, or glory in our Bibles, the glory of the Lord, the glory of Yahweh rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses from the midst of the cloud. And then verse 17, and to the eyes of the sons of Israel, the appearance of the glory of Yahweh. So what they see when they see the glory of Yahweh, when they see the glory of God, is this. It looks like a consuming fire on the mountaintop. So this is the appearance to the people of Israel, what the glory of God looks like, what the glory of Yahweh looks like in this case. We don't know exactly what Moses sees here. He's inside this cloud that is on the top of the mountain that looks from the outside like it's a consuming fire. But this is what's portrayed as the glory of Yahweh. Important later. So Moses entered the midst of the cloud, and as he went up to the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. So here is what I mentioned earlier. We're going to set a record for skipping chapters. So, it is kind of a shame when you think about the book of Exodus. Part of what we're skipping now, going to skip, is the information on the construction of the tabernacle. And the construction of the tabernacle, how to construct the tabernacle, really takes up about a third of Exodus. And when we talked about Exodus at the beginning, nobody mentioned the tabernacle, except after class somebody mentioned the tabernacle. So we don't really think of this as being part of Exodus. But it's about a third of it. About a third of the information here, or about a third of Exodus, is telling us about the tabernacle. Now, why is that such a big deal, and why in the world would we skip it? Well, it's a big deal because Exodus is about the presence of Yahweh with his people. And the tabernacle is, from this point forward, once they leave Mount Sinai, where the glory of Yahweh, the presence of Yahweh, is with the people in the tabernacle. They move the tabernacle, the cloud comes. And so it's what's in the tabernacle, how it's constructed, very, very, very important. The temple later in Israel is patterned somewhat as this tabernacle. So it's a tent, essentially, and the holiest part of the tent is only about 15 feet square. So it's not very big. But outside of that, there's more to it than that. But you've heard the Holy of Holies, or the most holy place. It's only about 15 feet square on the ground and 15 feet tall, so a cube of 15 feet. So if that... just skip forward into Revelation. If you think about Revelation, you know what that means. Symbolically, what happens at the end of time there. 15 by 15 by 15. Look it up later if you'd like. The other thing that we're going to skip is most of the information about, or most of the chapter on the golden calf, because everybody has seen the movie and knows what happens with the golden calf, right? So I'll just do a real quick summary of it, and then we'll pick it up at the end of this chapter, which is at the end of chapter 32 is where we'll pick it up. So Moses, he's up on the mountain. Remember, he's there for 40 days and 40 nights, a really, really, really long time, that means. And he, when the people see that it's taken him a long time to come down, you know what they do. They ask for Aaron to make a god for them. And so he does. He makes a calf for them. Now, a bull or a calf would be one of the most common, if not the most common, symbol of a god in the ancient Near East. So it's not something unusual for them to see a god made in the shape of a calf or a bull. They would expect that would be what you would do if you were going to make a god. And so they do that. Like that's so common in Egypt, in the land that they're going, they create a... Moses or Aaron creates some kind of a calf, something that they would recognize as a god. So he does that. And the people say this, depending on which version you have, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." Or, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you out up from under the land of Egypt. I actually think the latter version is more likely to be right, that it's talking about these are your gods who brought you up out of the land of Egypt, just because of the grammar that's used here. So ESV, I think, has these are your gods, right? So we have the right version for our church. So these are your gods who brought you up out from the land of Egypt. But notice what it, not just these are your gods. What has Yahweh told them that he's going to do? I will bring you out from under the burdens of Egypt. I will take you for my people. I will be your God. You will know that I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you up from under the burdens of the Egyptians. A direct, you know, affront or to the covenant that they have just made. You will have no other gods besides me or beside me. And if you go into these places and you make covenants with other people, you're likely to be take their gods, and they will be a snare to you. So this is directly after the people have made the covenant with God and said, everything that Yahweh says, we will do. Okay, everything he says, we will do. The first thing, the most important thing, no other gods. The end of the book of the covenant, no other gods. And so it is not just that it's a calf or it's some image. It is completely breaking in the covenant that they have just made with Yahweh. So they've just done this. And so, in just a very interesting point here, that as we go through chapter 32, what Aaron says back is, when the people say that these are your gods who brought you up out of the land of Egypt, is, tomorrow we're going to have a feast to Yahweh. We might lose that in the translation if it just says a feast to the Lord. No, it's talking about the name that Yahweh uses for himself. We're going to have a feast to him. Other gods beside me. So they're going to do both here. And we don't know what Aaron is thinking there, if he's thinking, well, this is a representative of Yahweh, or if he is thinking that, you know, in addition to this, this might look bad. We better do one for Yahweh, too. So worshiping alongside of Yahweh. So how God responds, how Yahweh responds, is he tells Moses this, leave me alone so that my anger can burn and I can consume them. So, and I will make you a great nation. So those are important things to note here. Leave me alone so that I can kill them all. So you walk away from me, Moses. My anger will burn, and I'll kill them. But then I'm going to make you a great nation. So why is that? What's the big deal here? He's going to bring, God is going to be faithful to his covenant that he made with Abraham. Israel has completely broken the covenant. Right? The people who are there have completely broken the covenant. And I will bring you into the land that I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So he's going to take Moses, fulfill what he promised them to do because he promised. He's faithful to his promises. So that's what God's going to do. So Moses then intercedes with, he says three things. Wait a minute, they're your people, right? You promised, I will take you for my people, who you brought out.
Second, why should the Egyptians speak badly about you, basically? Because remember, when he's bringing them out, that first point, I will bring you out from the burdens of the Egyptians. What's important is that everybody knows that I am Yahweh. So why should the Egyptians then, why should your fame, why should who they think you are be destroyed because you want to kill this people? And don't forget about your promise to Abraham. Well, he hasn't, but that's how Moses intercedes. Those three things which God has actually said. Okay, I'm going to bring you out. I want Egypt to know that I am Yahweh. And don't let them think that they can't do that. So, Yahweh changed his mind. That's what it says next in our Bibles. So what does that mean? What's the passage? What's the reference? God is not like a man that he should change his mind. Right? To Rehoboam, I can't remember for sure which king. No, it's to Saul, right? And it's to Saul, if I remember correctly. Early in the kings, anyway. One of those, he says that. He says, it's not like God is a man that he changes his mind. So what does this mean? Anybody want to take a stab at this? Nobody. Well, it does say that he changed his mind, but what happens, there are cases, there are a bunch of cases in the Old Testament where it talks about God changing his mind. We tend to take this to mean a certain kind of an idea that isn't really there in Scripture. Sure, that it does mean that God doesn't change his mind, but what is meant by that? Because things don't always mean the same thing, or we have a hard time. We create categories in our mind that mean something that Scripture doesn't really mean. Let's look at the book of Jonah for a second. And I'm going to come back to Jonah later. But Jonah, chapter 3, verses 6 through 10. So remember the story of Jonah. This is a good example of God, what God does when he changes his mind. Is that he sends Jonah to preach in a city called Nineveh and to tell them that he's going to destroy the city. And Jonah's not happy about it, but he goes. And here's what happens in chapter 3, beginning in verse 6. When the word reached the king of Nineveh, so he hears about this coming destruction, he arose from his throne, laid aside his robe from him, covered himself with sackcloth, and sat in the ashes. So this is a picture of repentance. And he issued a proclamation and it said, in Nineveh, by the decree of the king and his nobles, do not let man, beast, herd, or flock taste a thing. Do not let them eat and drink water. But both man and beast must be covered with sackcloth. And let men call on God earnestly, that each may turn from his wicked way and from the violence with which is in his hands. Who knows? God may turn and relent. The same idea between is changing his mind here. And withdraw from his burning anger, so that we will not perish. And when God saw their deeds, that they had turned from their wicked way, then God relented or changed his mind concerning the calamity which he had declared he would bring upon them. And he did not do it. So what's happened is the situation has changed, right? God was going to destroy them because they were wicked. It's pretty clear judgment that that's what's going to happen. But when they change, then he changes what he's going to do, how he's going to respond to that. The picture here is of real repentance by the people of Nineveh. So far, we're not there with Israel. We only have that Moses has been able to intercede for the people. And no big change of heart on their part. In fact, we haven't even gotten to the place yet where Moses comes down from the mountain and smashes the tablets, indicating that the covenant is broken. So the people don't even know, and yet Yahweh changes his mind based on Moses' intercession for them. So, verse 27, so now that the tablets have been smashed, and Moses has made the people drink water with gold dust in it, and he, verse 27, that is Moses, said to them, "Thus says Yahweh, the God of Israel, every man of you put his sword upon his thigh and go back and forth from the gate to gate in the camp and kill every man his brother and every man his friend and every man his neighbor." So these are probably the ringleaders. So the sons of Levi did as Moses instructed, and about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. And so that's the action that Moses takes when he comes down from the mountain. And he says, "Dedicate yourselves to Yahweh, for every man has been against his son and his brother in order that he may bestow a blessing upon you today." Think about that. Every man has been against his son and against his brother in order that he, that is Yahweh, may bestow a blessing on you today. It doesn't sound like one to us, right, so far. But then, and on the next day, Moses said to the people, verse 30, "You yourselves have committed a great sin, and now I am going up to Yahweh, and perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." Well, he can't make atonement for their sin, but he does go up and speak to God on their behalf. And I'll just summarize until we get to a little bit farther in Exodus 33. Now, let's start at the beginning of 33. We've got to hit this part about the angel. Exodus 33. "Then Yahweh spoke to Moses." Okay, so this is the people have broken the covenant. Moses has shattered everything. Some of the ringleaders have been killed. Moses has interceded. And Yahweh spoke to Moses, "Depart and go up from here." So now they're leaving Mount Sinai. They've been in the presence of God, in the presence of Yahweh, on Mount Sinai. "And you and the people who you have brought up out of the land of Egypt." So God isn't having any of this that Moses was saying, "You brought them up." Now he's telling Moses, "You brought them up to the land which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, to your descendants I will give it." So he's telling them, I'm still sending them to this land. Okay? Despite the fact that they have broken the covenant, and I will send an angel before you. So I'm still going to send an angel before you. And I will drive out the Canaanites and the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. And go up to the land flowing with milk and honey. But I will not go in your midst. So he said this is completely different from the earlier passage where he says, "I'm going to send an angel before you, and my name will be in him. right? My name, my reputation, who I am, will be in the angel. Instead, he says this, I'm going to send an angel, but I'm not going. I'm not going with you in your midst because of this stiff-necked people. Okay. The covenant is broken. And if I stay with them, I might destroy you on the way. So I'm not going along. And when the people heard this, verse 4, I don't like New American Standard here. When the people heard this sad word, it's better, I think ESV is disastrous, right? Disastrous word, evil word, better. Okay? Either one of those is better than sad. Okay? It's the word that's often translated calamity, evil, referring to bad things that are going to happen or bad things that happen. So the people heard this disastrous word. They went into mourning. None of them put on his ornaments, their fancy clothes and their jewelry for celebrations, for their good clothes. Nobody put on their good clothes, right? So just a few verses ago, I'm going to do this for your good, essentially, this, so that there can be a blessing on you. The killing of the 3,000 people, so that there can be a blessing on you. For Moses had said, for Yahweh had said to Moses, say to the sons of Israel, you are a stiff-necked people. Should I go up in your midst for one moment, I would destroy you. So I'm not going. I would destroy you if I went. Now, therefore, put off your ornaments. So keep these clothes off, basically, and then I'll know what I shall do with you. So the sons of Israel stripped themselves of their ornaments from this point on. So from Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai on. And we'll skip the next section down to verse 12. And Moses said to Yahweh, see, you have said to me, bring up this people. But you yourself have not let me know whom you will send with me. So God has told them, I'm not going with you. I'm sending an angel. And Moses is saying, I don't know what that means. Essentially, who is this that's going with us? I don't know who's going with us. So what is an angel that is not representing Yahweh in his presence? That's what we've seen so far. God is there with us, and now he's not going to be there because he might kill everybody if he goes. So Moses has a response to God, and his goal here is to get Yahweh to go along. And so he says, second part of verse 12, moreover, you have said, I have known you by name, and I have also found favor, and you have also found favor in my sight. Therefore, I pray to you, if I have found favor in your sight, let me know your ways, that I may know you, so that I may find favor in your sight. Consider, too, that this nation is your people. So what Moses is experiencing here in this is, whatever is happening now, I don't really know what's going on. I'm not sure that I understand this. What this means, that Yahweh is not going with us, what does that actually mean to us? He doesn't know. And so he says, show me, if I found favor in your sight, to this point, show me your ways. So what's going to happen now so that I can find favor in your sight? To this point, this has been one kind of a relationship, and now something different is going to happen. And don't forget that this is your people. And then God says to Moses, Yahweh says to Moses, and he said, verse 14, my presence will go with you is added in our versions. My presence will go, and I will give you, singular, rest. So I'm going to give you, Moses, rest. You. And Moses responds and says, if your presence does not go, do not lead us up from here. So God is making this personal about Moses, as Moses is saying, hey, it's not just me, it's me and the people. Right? So if you're not going to go, don't lead us up out of here. For how then can it be known that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people? So Moses is making this about the people and about Moses. God is willing to take Moses himself and make a nation out of him. Is it not by your going with us so that I and your people, stressing that, may be distinguished from all the other people on earth, all the other people who are on the face of the earth? So he has made a covenant with them. They have completely broken it. Moses would like to see that change, would like to see the people be saved. And Yahweh says to Moses in verse 17, okay, I will also do this thing which you have spoken. So Moses is successful again on his intercession, and Yahweh agrees to go with them. Okay? For you have found favor in my sight, and I have known you by name. So he agrees to do that, and then Moses' response, I pray you, verse 18, show me your glory. Okay, think about earlier on Mount Sinai. Still on Mount Sinai here. He asks for God to show him his glory. Show me your glory. Which looks like, from below, from the people on the ground, below the mountain, a consuming fire on the top of the mountain. But God responds differently. Yahweh says this, I will make all my goodness pass before you. Doesn't say glory here yet. Okay? And I will proclaim the name of Yahweh before you, and I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and show compassion on whom I will show compassion. We'll talk about those two things, about being gracious and compassion, later. They're in the New Testament quoted. This idea is quoted in the New Testament, but we'll talk about it a little bit farther down. And then he said, this is Yahweh again, you cannot see my face, for no man can see me and live. Okay. So, whatever that, whatever Yahweh is going to do, he's not going to let Moses see what he considers his face. And then Yahweh said, behold, there is a place by me, and you shall stand there on the rock, and it will come about when my glory is passing by. So now he is equating his glory to his goodness, because he's already said, I'm going to pass by you, and I'm going to let my goodness pass by you. So what we have here is something different, referred to as Yahweh's glory, than a fire consuming a fire on the top of a mountain. What I'm going to show you is my goodness, which is my glory, from a few verses earlier. And I'll put you in the cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by, and you will see my back, but you will not see. But my face shall not be seen. Next chapter, 34. So now Yahweh said to Moses, cut out for yourself two stone tablets like the former ones that he smashed. So what is happening here? God is saying, Yahweh is saying this. Let's do this again. I cut out stone tablets before you. I wrote on them. Let's do this again. Things are slightly different here. You cut out the stone tablets. But we're going to do this again. And I will write on the tablets the words that were on the former tablets, which you shattered. So be ready by morning and come up in the morning to Mount Sinai and present yourself there to me on the top of the mountain. No man is to come up with you, nor let any man be seen anywhere on the mountain. Even the flocks and the herds may not graze in front of that mountain. So this is what he had said earlier about Mount Sinai. Moses, you come up on the mountains, nobody else touches the mountain. Well, when they celebrated the covenant, God allows representatives of the people to come up partway on the mountain. Now we're back to square one here. Nobody else touches the mountain. Just you. You come up. So Moses did that. He cut out the stone tablets. He got up, went on his, and started up the mountain, verse 5. Then Yahweh descended in the cloud and stood there with him as he called upon the name of Yahweh. So as Moses is worshiping, Yahweh descends in the cloud and stood there with him. We don't know what that means, right? Exactly. Then Yahweh passed by in front of him and proclaimed this. So this is what Yahweh is doing. He says he is passing by now. So he said before, and I'm going to show you I'm going to let my glory pass by. I'm going to let my goodness pass by. This is what's passing by. Okay. Yahweh, Yahweh. So he said he would declare his name, right? That's my name. Yahweh, Yahweh. A God, compassionate and gracious. I'll read all the way through it and then we'll talk about some of these words. A God compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness and faithfulness, who keeps loving kindness for thousands and forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin, yet he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and on the grandchildren to the third and the fourth generations. So when God says, I'm going to make my goodness pass before you and make my glory pass before you, this is what he's talking about. So let's talk about those a little bit. A God compassionate and gracious. Okay, we have in our minds things that what compassionate means. We even name things like compassion childcare. And gracious. Yeah, we know what grace is, right? These are two terms that are used together, almost always used together. We saw it earlier in the last chapter. And they're never used of anybody but God. So whatever our human idea is of compassion, we struggle to come up with what this actually means, because it's only these are only attributes of God. So let's just look at, we were in Jonah. So let's look at what these mean. If Jonah chapter 4 will take over right from where we left off. A place where these two terms are used. They're usually, again, most of the time they're used together. So God says that he's going to, he turned from destroying the Ninevites, and then chapter 4, verse 1. But it greatly displeased Jonah. And he became angry, and he prayed to Yahweh and said, please, Lord, was not this what I said while I was still in my own country? In other words, this. I told you this was going to happen. Okay? Therefore, in order to forestall this, I fled to Tarshish. So I didn't want this to happen, so I ran away. But I knew it would happen, for I knew that you were a gracious and compassionate God. Same two words. Okay. Slow to anger, abundant in loving kindness. Also from this passage. And the one who relents concerning calamity. So that's a good example of what this means. And what's going on here is that God is compassionate or merciful in a way, gracious in a way, slow to anger in a way, abounding in loving kindness in a way that says this, that you'll change your mind about destroying people. That kind of compassion or mercy or graciousness. And then at the end of verse 6, loving kindness and faithfulness. Two other words that go together frequently. They're much more common. These words are much more common than the words compassion and gracious. And they don't always go together. Loving kindness or steadfast love in ESV is a word. It's much more common than the word for faithfulness, which is sometimes referred to as truth in some versions. Loving kindness and faithfulness, steadfast love and truth, those things. When they're used together, they're usually dealing with the covenant, with a covenant that God has made. Okay? His steadfast love in regard to His people that He has made a covenant with. His faithfulness to that people. And so, what has happened, though, is the covenant has been broken, right? The people have broken the covenant. However, God tells them and tells us, a God compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness and faithfulness, who keeps His loving kindness, He keeps His covenant faithfulness, who keeps His steadfast love to thousands. So, regardless of this people of Israel and what they are doing right now in shattering this covenant, or what they have just done in shattering the covenant, which they are giving a little picture of repentance here earlier in the last chapter, God is keeping His steadfast love for them. For thousands of them, because of what has happened before, because of His promise. And you could go back and say, because of His promise to Abraham as well. He keeps His covenant love for people, for thousands of people, based on what He has done, based on what He has said He will do. And that's the kind of God He is. Not only that, who forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin. So He forgives their sins. Not accidentally, three different words for things that we would call sin. One of which is the thing that Yahweh says He will forgive. That He said the angel would not pardon, the one that was with them earlier. Yahweh pardons that. So He is pardoning rebellion against Him. He is pardoning the sin of going after other gods. That's what He's doing here. That's who He is. Because of He is gracious, He is compassionate, He's slow to anger, He abounds in loving kindness, faithfulness, forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin. But He won't leave unpunished the guilty. Visiting the iniquity, we are out of time, but just for this passage here doesn't kind of tell what that means exactly. Yet he will by no means leave the guilty unpunishing, visiting the iniquity of fathers on the children and on the grandchildren to the third and the fourth generations. If you just flip over to Deuteronomy, which is, again, Deuteronomy is the second law. That's what it means. So it's telling us what has happened. So let's look at Deuteronomy 5 because it does tell us a little bit more about this. What is this talking about to the third and fourth generations? Deuteronomy 5, 6 to 10, and then we'll close with this. Deuteronomy 5, 6 through 10. This is recounting what has happened at the giving of the Ten Commandments. Verse 6. I am Yahweh your God who brought you out from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make a covenant for yourself, an idol, or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath, or in the water under the earth, and you shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on their children, and on the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me. Okay? But showing loving kindness and to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. There are other passages that refer to this also that talk about repentance. Or not repenting. So it's the people that hate God with the idea probably not of repenting that this iniquity gets visited on for three or four generations. But steadfast love to thousands. Very measured response on God's part. So with the iniquity. So let's we're going to close because I've already run over time. But thank you for today and for the rest of the study of Exodus.